Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
The boat's prow cut through the waves. The craft rocked back and forth as gusts of wind slapped against the planks, stirring up white caps on the river and shaking the stands of reeds along the banks. Driven onward by a half dozen paddles on each side, it slid through the water with surprising speed, making good time even while pulling against the force of the current. The 12 rowers were working hard, their shoulder and back muscles burning as they paddled, posteriors aching after long hours spent sitting on the narrow benches. As they neared the shore, the man sitting at the back of the boat stood up. His woolen cloak, white and decorated with a pattern of red chevrons, swirled around him with each gust. When it opened, swept aside by the wind, the triangular copper dagger carried in a leather sheath on his belt came into view. His right hand rested on the rough-hewn planks of the boat, sewn together with thick lengths of pliable yew wood. His left arm held a bow nearly as tall as him. A wrist guard made from polished stone protected his left forearm against the slapping of the bowstring. A dozen razor-sharp arrows sat in a quiver over his shoulder. The man barked an order. The rowers on the left side of the boat stopped, while those on the right side redoubled their efforts. They turned the boat toward a wooden dock extending out from the mass of reeds and grasses along the shore. Waiting there was a cluster of a half dozen people. Two women, diadems on their foreheads and their hair twisted into elaborate, upraised braids. A pair of plain-clothed servants holding large, bell-shaped ceramic containers impressed with the same kinds of chevron designs visible on the man's cloak. And two men, both wearing their own patterned woolen cloaks, stone wrist guards, quivers of arrows and daggers, bows clutched in their hands, a mirror image of the man approaching on the boat. There was a dull thud as the boat slid into the dock. The bowman standing at the back stepped up onto the wood planks and bowed to the assembled party. He began to speak, switching to a language different than what he had used to command the rowers. He came as a guest, he said, and requested friendship and hospitality from his hosts. The words for host and guest were the same, opposite sides of a reciprocal relationship that obligated both of them, both in the present and in the future. The hosts accepted, solemnly inclining their heads and replying in equally formal language. The two men on the dock handed their bows to one of the servants and took the ceramic beakers in turn, offering one and then the other to the guest. He drank deeply, little bits of thick, fermented porridge laced with honey and herbs adhering to his beard, and then handed the beakers back to his hosts. They too drank, sealing the relationship for now and all time to come. With the ritual complete, the guest looked over at the older of the two women. They shared a particular shade of dark hair, brown eyes, pale skin, and the same slightly lopsided smile. After a moment, they embraced. She was his sister, and they had not seen each other in several years. He embraced his brother-in-law next, then bowed to the other bowman on the dock, and to the younger woman accompanying him. If all went well, this young woman, his sister's niece by marriage, would soon become his son's wife, his daughter-in-law. If, that was, they could agree on a bride price. Hours of haggling over so many head of cattle, particular weight of copper, and the number of slaves to be exchanged. But that was the price of building a clan and the responsibility of a chieftain. His new daughter-in-law would travel to join his household, to cement the bond between her father and the guest. In times of danger, they would fight together, despite the dozens of miles separating their home villages. Both sides would be stronger for their relationship, and the other clans would be loath to cross them. Their boots thudded on the causeway as they walked through the reeds toward the village. Then, one of the servants carrying a ceramic beaker tripped over a plank and dropped it. The vessel shattered, grainy porridge spilling onto the wood, sherds cartwheeling off into the mud on either side of the walkway. Everybody paused. Several sharp intakes of breath split the silence of the riverbank. It was a bad omen. The guest sighed and exchanged a loaded glance with his sister. Perhaps this marriage wasn't meant to be. People could observe the proper rituals and make their oaths and their plans, but the gods would have their say as well. That was the way of the world. On they walked, leaving behind the sherds of the beaker to sink and settle into the mud, broken reminders of a world in motion. 4,500 years ago, a new set of goods began to appear all over Western and Central Europe. stone wrist guards, barbed and tanged arrowheads, triangular copper daggers, and most of all, decorated, bell-shaped ceramic beakers. From Morocco and Portugal to northern Scotland, Scandinavia, and Hungary, this particular package of items shows up with shocking speed, associated with the burials of important people, often in large burial mounds. Where the beakers appeared, transformation soon followed, and within a few centuries, the Bronze Age was born. But why? Are these bell beakers, as they're called, evidence of the migration of a new people, the bell beaker people, who moved and conquered over huge distances? Or are they evidence of a new ideology, a new way of thinking of power and authority? Today, we'll draw on everything from ancient DNA to isotopes to skeletal remains and pottery to try to unravel the mystery of the bell beakers. And also, I have some really cool news. I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. If you enjoyed our seasons of Tides on the early modern period, then you'll like this, I promise. The Verge comes out in July, but you can pre-order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook, which I'm reading, of course, from your distributor of choice right now. There's a link in this episode description that'll take you there. Enjoy! Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. For well over 100 years, archaeologists have puzzled over what's now called the bell beaker phenomenon. The distinctive ceramic containers from which the phenomenon derives its name show up all over Western and Central Europe between about 2600 and 2300 BC, spreading along the coasts and rivers in a matter of centuries, even decades. Hundreds and hundreds of these ceramic containers show up in earthen barrows in southern England, reused megalithic tombs in Denmark, villages in the Czech Republic, hilltop sites along the Tagus River in Portugal, in isolated spots in Sardinia and Sicily, and practically everywhere in between. When associated with stone wrist guards, arrowheads, and copper daggers, especially in burials, the beakers seem to point to new migrations, to new ways of organizing society, and the new connections that would soon produce a world defined by bronze. But as we learn more about this period and our archaeological and scientific knowledge improves, the bell beaker phenomenon gets harder to understand, not easier. The insights we draw from genetics, isotopes, chemical residue analyses, and large-scale studies of radiocarbon dating make the whole thing a confusing morass of data. Trying to figure out whether we're dealing with murderous conquerors, the missionary spread of a new religious system, peaceful migrations, or simply the movement of a new fashion across societies isn't clear. The bell beakers, those really characteristic and obvious artifacts, seem to mean different things in different places at different times. On the one hand, this makes perfect sense, right? We're mostly talking about a package of material goods. Taking an item or a set of items from one context to another naturally changes their meaning. A normal, commonplace thing in its place of manufacture might become a rare and prestigious item, even a source of social power, if it's transported hundreds of miles away. Things and ideas often move without permanent migrations of people, whatever the character of that migration. The fact that every trendy coffee shop in New York, Los Angeles, London, Zurich, and Sydney seems to look the same isn't solely or even mostly the product of the fact that people move between those widely separated cities. It's because the people in those cities who design and frequent trendy coffee shops have broadly shared expectations about what a trendy coffee shop is supposed to look like. But on the other hand, people absolutely do move. Often over long distances, often permanently, and they bring their things and ideas with them when they do. How can we tell these two different kinds of movement apart when we look at the archaeological record? For example, the sudden and intense distribution of thousands of similar ceramic containers and other artifacts. In a nutshell, this is one of the debates that's central to how we understand archaeology and the human past as a whole. Pots or people? Which one moves? Fashions change in archaeological thought from migration to goods and ideas and now back to migration again. The problem, of course, is that it's very obviously both. People migrate and their things and ideas move too. The hard part is figuring out exactly who migrated, for what reasons, how they interacted with the people who already lived in the new place where they arrived, and how migration fits in with other kinds of movement. Just because people migrate doesn't mean that they and other people don't take shorter journeys of all sorts of lengths, whether to trade, fight, and marry, or what have you. The reverse is also true. We can have periods without much migration where people are nevertheless really mobile. If we want to understand the Belbeekers, we'll have to take all of these things into account. There are good reasons why it's worth trying to understand these artifacts and the people behind them. The Belbeekers are at the origin of at least one major branch of the Indo-European languages. And they're the beginning of one of the major genetic lineages that's still present in Europe today. Along the way, we're going to have to deal with issues of migration, cultural change, and even the distinct possibility of Copper Age genocide. So let's dive in. Scholars have been excavating Belbeekers, these really distinctive S-shaped ceramic vessels, since the 19th century. For more than a century, archaeologists have traced their wide distribution and their association with those other artifacts I mentioned, especially the stone wrist guards and the copper daggers. These archaeologists of an older period generally equated any sort of movement of material artifact groupings like this to the migration of a coherent group of people, which they usually identified with an ethnic group or a race in the terminology of the early 20th century. This is called the culture-historical approach. People, material culture, language, and identity all went together in a neat package. If you were tracing artifacts, you were automatically tracing groups of people on their wanderings. In fact, the idea of a beaker people that went along with these S-shaped beaker artifacts was one of the core examples that made culture-historical archaeology the dominant way that archaeologists viewed their evidence for decades. In this way of looking at things, the beaker people spread out from a distinct point of origin, migrating to Iberia, the Mediterranean, the Atlantic coast of Europe, Britain, Ireland, Scandinavia, and Central Europe. Over time, as we head toward the 1960s, a new way of looking at things replaced culture-historical archaeology. This was called processual archaeology, and in general, it emphasized the movement of goods and ideas rather than the migration of coherent groups of people. This has fairly obvious implications for understanding the beakers, because instead of looking for beaker people who moved from place to place, we were looking for a beaker ideology, a way of looking at the world, a system of material goods and symbolic meanings. This ideology may have come into being at a particular place, but its spread would have been the product of networks and emulation rather than the migration of a coherent group of people. In this way of thinking, the beaker package, where it appears, was the material expression of a change in the social order and the way that they organized society. Neither of these approaches actually fully explained the evidence, even at the time. And the wealth of new data we've gotten in the last couple of decades makes things much harder to fit into either paradigm. In a seminal paper published in 2018 in the journal Nature, led by Iñigo Olalde, geneticists analyzed DNA from the remains of hundreds of people buried with beaker artifacts across Europe. They found that in a whole bunch of different places, beaker artifacts were associated with recent ancestry from the Eurasian steppe and a particular Y chromosome, a male line haplogroup, R1b M269. Outside of Iberia, which we'll talk about shortly, 84 of the 90 men analyzed in the study had this particular haplotype. 58 of 60 bore an even more specific version of this haplogroup, implying even more recent common ancestry. This means that everywhere from Ireland to Britain to France to Central Europe, almost all of the men buried with beaker artifacts shared a pretty recent male line ancestor. That ancestor had presumably migrated into Europe from the steppe in the couple of centuries prior to the appearance of beaker artifacts. Even more striking, this lineage of R1b is still dominant in Europe today. Millions of men living in Europe and beyond are directly descended from people associated with Belbeeker artifacts more than 4,000 years ago. So the genetic evidence makes it pretty clear that people, presumably large groups of people, were on the move, along with that package of beaker material culture we talked about. So was the old culture-historical approach right all along? Material culture, ethnic group, language, all of them traveling together over space and time. Simple story, right? No, it's not. That's because that same huge-scale study of beaker genetics tells us that this was not the case everywhere. In Britain and Ireland, the correlation between beaker artifacts and that distinctive ancestry was shockingly close. In Central Europe, it was present, but quite a bit weaker. In Iberia, which was home to some of the earliest bell beaker material culture and to some of its densest concentrations, the correlation barely existed at all. So this means that in some places, massive migration did carry beaker artifacts and the underlying culture with it. But in other places, there was very little or no migration associated with the movement of beaker artifacts. Sometimes it was people moving, and sometimes it was ideas and symbols, and sometimes it was both. When we drill down further and add other kinds of evidence, the picture gets even more varied, sometimes even from one farmstead or village to the next. The distribution of beakers is widespread but not continuous across Western and Central Europe. We can see some areas that completely rejected the beaker artifacts, and then others where they're incredibly dense on the ground. We can see some areas that formed really tight, integrated local networks where people and artifacts and ideas all moved together. In other places, we see the artifacts, like the beakers, but very little evidence of close connections or movement. We can see still other areas where people showed up with their beaker artifacts and completely displaced the folks who were already living there. There's no one story to tell about what the bell beakers actually were, the people who saw them as meaningful, and how and why they spread over such a huge swath of Western and Central Europe. Instead, there are a whole bunch of different stories. But all of those stories are rooted in movement. Different kinds of movement, over longer and shorter distances, longer and shorter timescales. But movement is the key to understanding them.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The story of the bell beakers begins, probably, in Iberia. So when you want to figure out how old something is in absolute terms, radiocarbon dating is the way to go about it. But radiocarbon dates have to come from organic material, like charcoal or bone. You can't take a piece of ceramic pot or a stone arrowhead or a copper dagger and get a radiocarbon date from it. Before radiocarbon dating existed, archaeologists dated everything in relative terms. Older stuff was found in layers below the newer stuff, basically, though it's an art and a science to do this right. Radiocarbon dating isn't exactly straightforward either, where you just hand over your sample and get a precise date back. There are a whole bunch of things that can affect the data. If you test the bone of a person who ate a lot of freshwater fish, for example, it can make the date look older than it actually is because of what are called marine reservoir effects. If you've got a piece of wood that had already been dead for a long time when it was used in a building or a fire, the date will be off. Even in the best case scenario, where your sample is good, radiocarbon dating actually gives you a range of probabilities rather than a specific date. That's why you always want as many samples as possible for dating. The more you have, the more restricted the range of probabilities becomes, and the more precise your dating gets. Some recent research has begun to do really large-scale dating projects on a bunch of different periods, including the European Neolithic, but we're not yet fortunate enough to have these across the whole continent for the bell beaker period. This means that we can't exactly tell when the bell beaker material begins to appear in absolute terms, or be totally certain where it appears earliest. When it comes to the bell beakers, the earliest dates associated with the characteristic beakers seem to show up in Iberia around 2700 BC. If these dates are correct, and there is some disagreement among specialists on this, then the Bell-Beaker phenomenon remained confined to Iberia for at least a century before it showed up anywhere else. And not just Iberia in general, but specifically the area around the estuary of the Tagus River, near present-day Lisbon in Portugal. Again, assuming this is right, only one aspect of the beaker phenomenon was really to be found there. Just the beakers themselves, with their characteristic decorations, not the wrist guards, not the arrowheads, not the triangular copper daggers. And if you think back to our talk about the genetic data, the Iberian finds of the characteristic beakers weren't particularly associated with that specific ancestry or the Y chromosome haplotypes that show up elsewhere in Western and Central Europe. Around 2600 BC, about a century after we think people started to make the distinctive beakers in what's now Portugal, these vessels start to show up a heck of a long way away from there, around the mouth of the Rhine River in what's today the Netherlands. That's 1,200 miles, or just shy of 2,000 kilometers as the crow flies. It's considerably further if you have to make the actual journey by boat around the Atlantic fringe of Western Europe. In fact, there's a contingent of scholars who argue that because of the dating issues we talked about earlier, the Netherlands is actually the place where we see these beakers show up the earliest. So we've got two options for the origin of the Bell-Beaker package. Iberia, specifically the Tagus Estuary, or the mouth of the Rhine. But those places aren't exactly next door to each other, and very different things were happening there around 2600 BC. Iberia was home to communities of Neolithic farmers who'd been established there for millennia. The mouth of the Rhine was home to recent migrants of the corded-ware culture. Both places have earlier, but again very different, stylistic pottery antecedents for the beaker type. A smaller version in Iberia called a copos, with similar decoration, and one in the Netherlands called a protruding foot beaker. On balance, Iberia seems more likely as the earliest home, but there's no obvious straightforward connection that explains why those two places, and not others, show evidence of the beakers before anywhere else. It's possible that there was something like convergent evolution toward this particular beaker form, drawing on different antecedents in different places, that eventually morphed into a coherent package. If it was Iberia, we've got a conundrum on our hands, because it's just the beakers there. It's only when the beakers start showing up elsewhere, like the mouth of the Rhine and beyond, that we see the really strong associations between the beakers, the archery equipment, the daggers, and the steppe ancestry. Clearly, something happened on the way from the Tagus estuary to everywhere else, but we don't know precisely what that was or when and where it happened, much less why. Somebody or some group took a fancy to the distinctive Iberian decorated S-shaped beakers and made them part of a broader symbolic system. This group was presumably descended in large part from recent migrants from the steppe. It was organized around a male lineage that bore the R1B M269 haplotype, probably something more like an extended clan than a tribe. From this point of origin, the beaker phenomenon expanded far and wide, and some of the people associated with that clan went with it. It's possible that this happened in Iberia. Some of the ancient DNA samples from Iberia associated with beaker artifacts, about 25% of them, do have some steppe ancestry. In this scenario, a group of migrants from the steppe made the long journey to the southwest, adopted these beakers, and then moved on again, heading in multiple directions to the north and east. It's plausible, but we don't really know. Until we get more DNA samples and more and better radiocarbon dates, it's going to remain a mystery. What happened after this is a bit clearer. The beaker package, complete with wrist guards and copper daggers, established itself most firmly around the mouth of the Rhine River in what's now the Netherlands. This is low-lying ground laced with streams, meandering channels, and wetlands. It's densely populated and tightly connected, even at this point in time. It's easy for us to imagine boats made from hollowed-out logs and sewn planks paddling back and forth across estuaries and along the river, going from village to village, farmstead to farmstead. Information, ideas, goods, and people would have traveled there. Traders offering high-quality flint or raw copper, young men going to live with an uncle for a few years, women leaving their father's home to marry and join their husband's household. This is what we would call a regional network, and it was through local connections like this that the beaker package, the actual beakers, the archery equipment, the weapons, and the ideas were actually adopted. The area around the mouth of the Rhine was the densest, the most tightly connected of all the regional networks that we can associate with the beaker phenomenon. A Dutch scholar named Jos Kleine recently wrote a fascinating doctoral dissertation that used the tools of network analysis to try to understand the Beakers and how, where, and why they were adopted. He points to the Lower Rhine as the densest of these networks, but there are several other clusters that show up in a bunch of different places. In Portugal, which we already talked about, in Western France, and in what's now the Czech Republic. When we dig into the evidence from each of these, when we try and look at the networks, the Beaker phenomenon looks a little bit different from place to place. The people who adopted the Beaker package around the mouth of the Rhine mostly seem to have been the same people who lived there a couple of centuries earlier, with a corded ware expansion into that region, which was also pretty peaceful. Maybe there were a few new arrivals, but the Beaker phenomenon there looks like the adoption of a new symbolic system, a way of thinking about power and society, simply spread from place to place through pre-existing networks and relationships. In Western France, by contrast, Beaker pottery, those distinctive ceramic vessels, appear in their highest concentrations at a series of new settlements along the coast. Then they spread inland from there. The most likely explanation for this involves migrants arriving en masse from elsewhere, maybe coming north from Iberia, maybe south from the Netherlands. The new migrants then interacted with the local people, the descendants of Neolithic farmers who were long established in the region. Beaker pottery shows up a bit later in established inland sites, though in much lower quantities than along the coast, and it seems clear that intermarriage and interbreeding took place. A man was buried with Beaker artifacts near Carcassonne in southwestern France. About a quarter of his ancestry was derived from steppe migrants, probably the descendants of these people who had shown up along the coast. The rest was from Neolithic people. In Central Europe, particularly in the Czech lands, the story is once again different. There seems to have been only a little migration in that case, but Beaker artifacts show up in exceptionally high and uniform concentrations. Jos Kleine's network analysis suggests that what we see is, again, a pre-existing network of villages through which the Beaker package, artifacts and ideas, spread with exceptional density. Based on the similarities of artifact styles, this package came from elsewhere, probably the Lower Rhine. The route by which it came is pretty clear. The Elbe River, which runs northwest from the Czech Republic through Germany to the North Sea. It's not a coincidence that the Beaker artifacts in the Czech lands are found in their highest concentrations around tributaries of the Elbe River. In fact, the Beaker finds in the southeastern Czech Republic are the most numerous anywhere in Europe. And yet, there's little reason to think that very many people came from outside the region. The genetic data seems to tell us that the people associated with Beaker artifacts were essentially the same as those who'd lived there before. Basically, the ideas and artifacts were imported and then spread within a tight network of villages and farmsteads. Contrast this with the northern tip of Jutland, the peninsula that mostly makes up Denmark. There are lots of Beakers there, again, evidence for a tight network, and probably some migration from further to the west. But the date of adoption is quite late. This is a couple centuries after Beakers show up in the Lower Rhine, a century after they show up in the Czech Republic. The key point is that the distribution of Beaker artifacts is discontinuous. They don't show up in uniform quantities all over the map, but in specific clusters. There were tons of Beakers in southern France around the mouth of the Rhone River, and they're found in smaller quantities all along the Mediterranean coasts of Spain and France. There was another cluster in Lombardy in northern Italy, but almost none along the Italian coast. Moreover, this wasn't all happening at the same time. Some regions were earlier than others. In some places, the Beaker phenomenon lasted for centuries. It became a deeply rooted part of the material culture and the language of society, like in Britain. That was also the case in Jutland, around the mouth of the Rhine, elsewhere that we'll discuss shortly. But in other places, it was a passing fad. It only lasted for a couple of decades. The Beaker package shows up in northern Germany, but it never really caught on there. Beakers have been found along the Atlantic coast of Morocco, but there's no sign of upheaval or mass migration. In northern France, it seems like the local people were exposed to Beaker artifacts, like the pottery and archery equipment, and actively chose to reject it. Nearby settlements were full of these distinctive Beakers for decades, even centuries, but they never showed up in these contemporary settlements in northern France just a few miles away. These people, whoever they were, wanted nothing to do with them. Maybe they were symbolic of an invading group. Maybe they were symbolic of a way of organizing the world that was anathema to them. Whatever the reason, the Beakers and the ideas behind them held no appeal. We can be certain that there were other places like this, other pockets where that particular clan of migrants didn't go, where the ideas and artifacts couldn't penetrate or alter the fabric of local society. But in many other places, the Beaker people and their worldview did make a huge impact.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
No region of Europe was more thoroughly transformed by the full Bell Beaker package, artifacts, people, and their genes, than Britain. Over the course of a century or more, probably in a few different waves, new migrants from the continent arrived. They introduced their distinctive beakers and other items and spread out from place to place, all the way from the southern coast of England to the northernmost reaches of Scotland. Most striking is the fact that the genetic data suggests that these new arrivals almost completely displaced the Neolithic farmers who had previously occupied Britain. Within a few centuries, more than 90% of the ancestry in Britain was traceable to the Bell Beaker folk rather than their Neolithic predecessors. That is an enormous turnover. It's a near-complete replacement of the existing population over the course of a few hundred years at the very most. Thanks to recent discoveries and the application of new techniques, especially genetics and isotope analysis, we can understand both the process of Beaker migration and these people's lives in exceptional detail. We can tell a series of stories about individual people in a way that's pretty incredible. And when we put them together, they give us incredible insight into one manifestation in one region of the Beaker phenomenon. Sometime after 2450 BC, maybe a century or so after they show up in the Lower Rhine region, the distinctive S-shaped decorated bell beakers begin to show up in graves in southern England. They aren't the only thing in these graves. We see barbed and tanged arrowheads, stone wrist guards, copper daggers, and a series of other personal ornaments like bone pins and gold earrings, none of which have prototypes in the British Neolithic. They're new, and they were brought to southern England by migrants from the continent. Where did these people come from exactly? Well, that's harder to say. When we look at the genes of British Beaker folk, the population that looks closest to them is to be found in the Netherlands, specifically Beaker people buried at a place called Oostwoud, a little ways north of Amsterdam and right on the coast. That doesn't mean the people in the Netherlands were the direct ancestors of the British Beaker folk, but that of all the remains we've sampled, they're the closest. Maybe both groups descended from a common source population elsewhere, two migrant groups that had arrived in their new homes over a widely separated distance. Plenty of pieces of Beaker pottery have been found just across the channel from southern England, especially in Brittany, but we have no genetic data from there to tell us who was using them or how those people were related to the British migrants. One thing we can say for certain is that at least some of the Beaker migrants had come from a very, very long way away. In 2002, archaeologists working near Stonehenge discovered an incredible burial dating to shortly after the first arrival of Beakers in England. There, buried in an oval-shaped pit, was a man around 40 years of age. He had a hole in his jaw, the result of a painful abscess. And at some point in the past, he had suffered a crippling injury to his left knee that left him with an awful bone infection that destroyed his patella. Whoever this man was, however, he mattered. He was a person of real importance. 5 Beaker pots, 2 stone wrist guards, 3 copper daggers, 15 fine flint arrowheads, 4 boar's tusks, and a pair of gold ornaments accompanied him in death, making this one of the richest burials associated with Beaker artifacts anywhere in Europe. Even more surprising, the Amesbury Archer, as he's known, was not a local. That's what stable isotope studies of his tooth enamel tell us. He had come to southern England from a long, long way away. Perhaps the Middle Rhine, or alternatively, even southern Germany or the Swiss Alps, where he'd spent his childhood and adolescence. The Amesbury Archer makes a great argument for Beakers as a people. He's a long-distance migrant, he's a man, buried with weapons and Beaker pots. Whoever put him in the ground with those things was trying to make a statement about who he was and who they were, which had to be different from other people they saw around them. Other Beaker burials in Britain aren't as rich, but they speak to these same dynamics. a new population moving in with a new material culture and a different way of life. Thanks to Stable Isotope Studies, in particular a project led by the extraordinary archaeologist Mike Parker Pearson that examined hundreds of sets of remains, we can get a sense for multiple aspects of the British beaker folk. Their diets are remarkably uniform across Britain. They ate very little grain, some vegetables, but mostly relied on meat and animal products. What grain they consumed was in the form of fermented alcoholic beverages, perhaps consumed in their distinctive beaker containers for reasons that had to do with religious observance or ritual. Despite often living within spitting distance of the ocean and rivers and obviously using boats for transportation, not a single beaker person shows any evidence of having consumed marine resources like fish or shellfish. As far as these samples tell us, they just didn't do it. But these stable isotope studies also complicate our view of the beaker folk as migrants. With a few exceptions, like the Amesbury Archer, very few of the beaker people in Britain can be firmly identified as migrants from the continent or elsewhere. This is partially a product of the data. We're getting better at interpreting strontium and oxygen isotopes, but because the data is telling us about the geological composition of different regions, we can have trouble telling apart regions that are geologically similar. For example, if you take two people who grew up on either side of the English Channel, they're probably going to have an almost identical isotope ratio in their tooth enamel. This means that identifying the absolute origin of a person via isotopes can be hard or impossible. But on the other hand, isotopes are great at telling us if somebody isn't local to the place where they were buried. For the British beaker folk, this kind of data points to an exceptionally high level of mobility within Britain. These people were constantly on the move. They were following their herds from pasture to pasture, going from region to region, moving to join a spouse or family members over those hills or on the other side of that river. I want you to bear this mobility in mind because we'll see it again elsewhere in the territory occupied by beaker folk. For whatever reason, the beaker complex is strongly associated with movement and mobility, especially in Britain, but also elsewhere. So let's meet one of these British beaker people. Sometime between 2300 and 2200 BC, a couple of centuries after the first migrants arrived in southern England, maybe a few generations after the Amesbury Archer was buried near Stonehenge, a woman was buried in the far north of Scotland, in the region of Caithness, at a place called Achavanach. She was young, between 18 and 25. Her hair was dark, almost black, and her skin pale, with brown eyes set into a wide face. To create a grave pit for her, the people of her community excavated nearly half a ton of rock. Then they built a stone box called a kist to hold her remains. They placed her carefully inside, lying on her right side with her knees pulled up to her shoulders, perhaps tightly wrapped in a burial shroud. A distinctive beaker went into the kist with her, filled with an alcoholic porridge or gruel flavored with honey, birch and alder sap, and flower heads. A couple of flint scrapers and a cattle scapula, a shoulder blade, were also placed inside. The scholars who have studied this woman extensively call her Ava, and so will we. Ava ate a healthy diet much like that of other British beaker folk. Meat, vegetables, animal products, and very little grain. She was in good health, but had gone through periods of stress earlier in her life, perhaps as a result of malnutrition or illness. The isotope values in her tooth enamel suggest that she was local to the region of Caithness where she died. She'd probably grown up there, maybe a few miles to the west and south of the precise location where she was buried, but not too far. Ava's genes, on the other hand, show us that her ancestors were recent migrants to the region. She clusters with other British beaker folk from all across the island, and with beaker folk from the continent. None of her ancestry, so far as we can tell, derives from the Neolithic people of Britain. In this, Ava is exactly like the other beaker people whose remains have been tested for DNA in Britain. They imply strong separation between the Neolithic farmers, assuming they were still around, and the new migrants. Ava was a descendant of the migrants and lived in a community made up of people like her. So how should we understand this? How should we understand Ava? What happened to the Neolithic people of Britain? Since the bombshell genetic data dropped a few years ago, scholars have been trying to explain precisely how 90% of the ancestry in Britain could turn over in just a few centuries. This is an extreme example of what we talked about earlier, about the high levels of steppe ancestry and that male lineage that was so strongly correlated to beaker-associated people outside Iberia. There are a few simple explanations. The Neolithic people were either already gone, maybe killed off by a plague or stricken by internecine warfare, or they were forced out of prime land by the Beaker folk and marginalized until they mostly died out. In this case, perhaps the Beaker folk like Ava and her relatives committed a Copper Age genocide. We shouldn't discount this hypothesis just because it's distasteful, but it should be noted that we haven't found any solid evidence to point to large-scale violence in this period. The Beaker people actually show less skeletal evidence for trauma and violence than early Neolithic people in Britain, for example. Still, it's a possibility and one we should bear in mind. Now, maybe, some scholars have said, about both Britain and Beaker people elsewhere, we're just dealing with a case of sampling bias. The Neolithic people were still there, but they cremated their dead instead of burying them. We know that cremation was an extremely popular burial rite in this place and time, and if you're cremating a person and not interring them with grave goods, how would we know? We see an inhumation, we see a beaker, we test for DNA, and we find that specific signature. But we're only looking at a tiny subset of all the people who were alive and who were buried at a particular point in time. Not all burials, or all settlements, or all groups of people are equally archaeologically visible. This is all true, and it's worth bearing in mind. But particularly for Britain, there's a significant problem with it. If we were looking at a situation with archaeologically visible Beaker migrants and archaeologically invisible Neolithic natives, then eventually we'd expect the two groups to come together in more equal proportions of ancestry. Sure, we might see populations that don't mix early on, but given 500 or 1,000 years, they would come together in more equal proportions. This is, for example, what we see with Mesolithic hunter-gatherers and Neolithic farmers across much of Europe 2,000 years before the Beaker people. Very little hunter-gatherer admixture in farmers at first, and then progressively more over time. But we don't see this at all in Britain. The Neolithic farmers contribute only about 10% of ancestry to later inhabitants of Britain even after 20 or 30 generations. That's a long time, and the proportion never rises afterward. They're just kind of gone. I'm betting that there were a couple of different things going on here, both in Britain and maybe more broadly. First, I'd say there's a strong chance that there were far fewer Neolithic farmers living in Britain before the Beaker folk arrived than there had been a couple of centuries or millennia in the past. Local and regional population declines are common things. If a group of migrants showed up and found good land without a lot of people on it, they'd keep coming. Before long, continuous migration, even on a very small scale, just family groups, individuals even, that could shift the ancestry percentages in the way we see in Britain. But second, I don't think we can discount the possibility of violent conflict, especially if there was an ideological or religious dimension. Remember, we don't know exactly what the Bell Beaker package symbolized, what it meant, how it fit in with broader belief systems. It's possible that the visible trappings, which relate pretty clearly to the desire to project a warrior identity, created a strong sense of us versus them. In that context, violent conflict might be easier. I want to come back to archaeological visibility, though. We're just not seeing the whole picture. In southern Germany, archaeologists have excavated two cemeteries with Beaker associations, one at a place called Alberg and the other at Irlbach. They're just 12 miles, 17 kilometers apart, both of them on the right bank of the Danube. They were both in use at pretty much the same time, too. There aren't actually a lot of the characteristic Beakers in the cemeteries, believe it or not, but they belong in this period and there are enough artifacts, like copper daggers, arrowheads, boar's tusk pendants, and the like, that we can place them within this tradition. A paper led by Carl Göran Searing did a really in-depth investigation of these two cemeteries and the people buried within them, combining genetics and stable isotopes to give us a fascinating picture of who these Beaker folk really were, and who they weren't. All of the men in both cemeteries belonged to that distinctive male lineage defined by Y chromosome haplogroup R1b M269. The women, by contrast, had exceptional diversity in their female lineages, their mitochondrial DNA haplogroups. 14 different haplogroups among 18 people at Irlbach, 9 among 16 at Alberg. None of the mitochondrial DNA haplogroups were shared among the two cemeteries, so there was no overlap in the maternal lines between the two places, despite the proximity of the settlements in space and time. Moreover, the women's isotope signatures were overwhelmingly non-local. So we're seeing a tremendous gendered difference here. Men and women were living much different lives with very different patterns of ancestry and mobility and marriage than men were. The study's authors sum it up like this. We're looking at a society based around nuclear families that emphasized the male lineage, a patriarchal, patrilineal society. They were also patrilocal. Women moved to join their husbands, a practice called female exogamy. As best we can tell, only one man in a generation would have inherited from his father, leaving his brothers to go out and make their own ways in the world. Essentially, this was a world oriented around the household of a leading male figure, a patriarch, who sent his sons out to be fostered by their relatives and friends, and his daughters to marry. This created a thick web of kin relationships that connected one household to others, a series of clans, maybe tribes, whose material manifestations we can see in the Bell Beaker artifact package and especially in the genes. So this is a relatively straightforward story. It matches some aspects of the evidence pretty well. The genetics, the distribution of artifacts, the rapid expansions through dense networks of interaction that we can see in places like the Lower Rhine in Britain. Yet, we're not seeing the whole picture here. Surely, there were other people living in this world who were not a part of that direct male line. They just weren't buried in easily recognizable tombs or cemeteries with distinctive grave goods like the beakers and daggers and archery equipment. The authors of that study say exactly this. Maybe these other people weren't buried at all because they weren't important enough to bury, or they had their own less visible customs. Maybe the Neolithic people of Britain who were living there when the Bell Beaker folk arrived were like that, a particularly large category of invisible people. I'd say that the beakers and their associated artifacts were signs of prestige. The people who used them, who wanted to be seen with them in life and in death, were special in some way. Maybe they were an elite group of warriors. Maybe they were master metalworkers, a skill with mystical and religious associations in a world where metal wasn't common. Maybe their membership in that distinctive male lineage overlapped with those other special categories. We know that this was a world defined by movement, where artifact types and the ideas behind them could move over enormous distances, where people could travel from village to village and region to region. The archaeologist Jos Kleine, whom I mentioned earlier, has a fantastic argument that brings these two things together. Maybe what made the Beaker folk special was the fact that they moved. The similarity of the Beaker artifact package over long distances was the whole point. It was a thing they shared in common, which overlapped with their shared ancestry and language. It was a thing that allowed them to maintain these strong connections with distant relations and to build new ones. If you were dressed the right way, if you knew the right words to say with a beaker full of the right fermented beverage, then you had access to all of these distant places and the people who lived there. You belonged in that world. It was a world growing in scale and population. If the beaker folk were some kind of elevated group in society, then the world of the Bronze Age that followed saw the rise of ever more exalted elites. Princes, tribal leaders, chieftains, who could build fortresses, muster armies, and be buried with huge hoards of wealth. The beakers are a bridge between that world of hierarchy and scale and the Neolithic world that preceded it. An elite that brought a whole continent together, at least for a while. Next time on Tides, we'll be turning our attention back to the east, toward the great grasslands of the Eurasian steppe. Even as migrants left the steppe behind and headed west into the forests and hills of Europe, making their mark on the genes and languages of their new home for millennia to come, things didn't stop out on the grasslands. New cultures developed, groups of people kept migrating, and new ways of life came into being. These ways of life would leave behind their own legacies, everywhere from the Black Sea to the Indian Ocean to China. Until then, thanks for joining me. If you'd like to see some visuals of the things I've talked about today, go to patrickwyman.substack.com, where I'm posting pictures and videos in a post to go along with each episode. I've written a book called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It comes out in July, but you can pre-order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice right now. There's a link in this episode description that'll take you there. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman, on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick, or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left us a 5-star rating and a review.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.